From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you are feeling hopeless today about politics, and I'm not even talking about who you supported for president. That's ironically one thing a lot of us agree on, that we're in a hyper-partisan atmosphere in this country, and people have sorted themselves into party or culture or philosophy, whatever you want to call it, and the other guys are idiots, right? All of this stuff is going to flare up again now, but let's face it, it's not new. The question is, are we too far gone to fix it? We're going to hear from people today who say it's not too late, that there are mechanisms to find common ground and that there's the will to do it. But there's another side that suggests we may not be able to come together, not in an era of social media where we can always just hang out with only the people who agree with us. This is kind of a twist on the Rodney King question. Can we actually just get along? Join us after the news.
Support for Radio West comes from thousands of sustainers, listeners just like you who give ongoing monthly donations to help pay for the public radio shows they rely on. Show your love for Radio West by becoming a sustainer, starting at just $5 a month at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. As if it wasn't hard enough to find common ground in this country, the scholar Jason Gainis says technology has made it even more difficult. You would think the internet would be helpful in the political process because even though information wouldn't make people on different sides of a conflict agree, you figure that at least you would have something real and accurate to begin the debate. But Gainis says that's not really how the information age is working out. He says social media and the internet represents a fundamental shift in the way people interact with each other and obtain information. And it's not making us more reasonable. It's making us more, in some cases, extreme. Today in the program, we're talking about whether we're going to be able to come together as a country, as all the country's political figures seem to be saying. We know we're in a polarized environment. The question is why? Is it us? Or is it baked into our systems and our technology? Are people really interested in common ground? Or are we more interested in finding something that just confirms what we already believe or feel? Jason Gainis is going to join us first in this conversation. He's a professor of political science at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, co-author of the book Tweeting to Power, The Social Media Revolution in American Politics. Professor Gainis, welcome to you. Thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Doug.
So I guess I want to begin with, there's always hand-wringing about technological change, and there's always change, of course. But you say that the character of the change is new, is distinctive. Let's start there. We always disagree, we always squabble, but you say now with technology it's different. Let's start there.
Okay. I think you are absolutely correct that with the advent of radio and then television and then 24-hour cable news, it was, to many, dooming. And fundamentally altering. There were so many arguments about how it was going to change the way people perceived reality, the political discourse. And in many ways, it did. But I would suggest that the difference with digital technology is that now more than ever, it gives the individual consumer far more control over the information that they digest. Yeah. And once they have control, then their own psychology, their own political predispositions, all of these things play out in a way that changes the information they have accessible.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. One of the things you point out is the more information people have, the more extreme they are. Like, it's not making us sure. More reasonable. It's making us just like, no. You're damn right. Look at that. That absolutely confirms what I always thought.
Yeah, it does. And the idea here, I mean, let's talk about social media in particular.
Yeah.
It started before social media, but social media has just ramped up this effect and both by its algorithms and the people using it.
Right.
And people do not like to be exposed to information that challenges their predispositions. Mm-hmm. And this goes back to psychological theory dating to the 50s. So the idea of cognitive dissonance is that we don't like internal conflict. It's uncomfortable. And if we are exposed to information that challenges our predispositions, it makes us uncomfortable. And so you bring social media into the mix, and what people are able to do then is you just think about your Facebook news feed and look down at it, and you have people's political commentary, individual postings, news stories being posted. And what people tend to do is those postings that are consistent and reinforcing of their own beliefs, they're more likely to comment on them. Mm-hmm. They're more likely to like them. They are more likely to share them. And when they're doing all of this, the algorithm for Facebook is picking this up, and then it's populating their newsfeed with postings from the same people with whom they're interacting. And if that's happening and they're just interacting with birds of the same feather, then their newsfeed gets populated with reinforcing information, and everyone is sort of living in a filter bubble. Mm. And if so, the idea then, of course, is that your attitude, what you think, any disposition or framework of reference that you have to make sense out of the world around you is just based on the information you can draw upon. And if that information you can draw upon is increasingly biased mm-hmm. toward the predispositions you already have, then your attitudes are just going to become more extreme.
So the algorithm, it gets exponentially worse as the algorithm figures you out more.
Yeah. And the amazing thing about that is that the algorithm, your conspiracy theorist will think that it's trying to bias people one way or another. And in the end, all they're trying to do is create a product that consumers like. And so they're trying to populate your newsfeed with things that you like. And the unintended consequences are the political – one of the unintended consequences are how it shapes people's political attitudes. And it's really phenomenal.
This was interesting too, and I have to say kind of troubling. I don't know what to make of this, but you found that the more one-sided the information is that people gather – the more inclined they are to vote and participate.
Yeah, that was we didn't know. This was in our earliest work when we started looking at this back in 2011, 2010. And we were trying to think about, what's the bright side of this? And if people think that political participation is a good thing, and let's be honest, that's debatable. But nonetheless, if we, generally speaking, most Americans think political participation is a good thing, then just think of it. What ends up happening is if people are more extreme in their opinion, then they're going to be more likely to want to express that opinion via our institutions. The single most institution we have to do that is through voting,
right.
And so the more extreme they become, the more likely to their vote. And think of the consequences then. If the electorate is becoming more extreme on both ends, and then as a result more likely to vote, and we didn't think of this then those candidates that cater to those more extreme positions are more likely to be elected, and as a result then you look at a Congress that's reflecting the polarization that's in the public, and we get what we get, which is a Congress that's basically sits in stalemate.
So what you're saying is that we have basically baked into a system an impulse that the less informed you are, the more likely you are to vote. We have baked into the system an incentive for ignorant people to be more.
Well, I don't know that I would say that.
Okay.
I don't know that I'd say that.
All right.
Because like what it would do is it's people with. That they're not. I mean, you could almost make a case that if they're ignorant, it's only ignorant of the counterposition.
Right. But that's right? what you want.
So they're full of information.
Yeah.
And we've even shown too that the more people use the internet, the more likely they are to be able to answer some basic sort of questions about how U.S. government functions.
Yeah.
But then if you go to issues, the arguments that they're going to be able to pull up for one side of the issue as opposed to the other, they're more likely to be able to pull up arguments that are one-sided.
Yeah. Well, but that sort of gets to this question, you know, okay, so we're trying to figure out today on the show, are we going to be able to come to common ground? And you've got to have that impulse of wanting to explore both sides if you're going to find common ground. And what you're saying is in the internet age now, we don't really have that impulse because we don't have to really explore the other side.
And exploring the other side for most people is uncomfortable.
And so why
would they do that? Now, I don't want to suggest there are people out there that are probably less likely to experience this kind of internal conflict. And then there are people you've also got to bring into it. Some people are socialized into through their upbringing, through schooling, parental socialization, socialized into multiple viewpoints where they end up somewhere around the middle. And maybe these people are, more likely to weigh both sides. But increasingly, I mean, all we have to do is look at the election outcome and look at the way people are responding to realize that these people are few and far between.
So I guess maybe you've answered this. I wanted to know, how unique is it to find that person who comes to an issue and is willing to just take what they find and go with that, you know, sort of really in a objective way, say, I want to figure this out. I mean, that seems like a kind of rare magical creature, frankly.
You know, like where I think this is probably most likely to happen is in non-salient issues, those issues that are not highly politicized. Because once they become highly politicized, then the camps are drawn, the camps are set, and then the flow of information starts. And you've also got to remember that we have elite interests flowing information that serves their electoral interests if they're politicians, if they're interest groups. And so they are promoting a flow of information and using this tool to benefit themselves.
Yeah.
And then it just continues to spin out of control.
I want to ask you about the sort of the physical aspect of the internet, the fact that there's no actual give and take. I mean, you're not with someone in the same room. You're not talking to them. You're not engaging with body language and, you know, just the basic aspects of discourse. You can make a statement and then you can just sort of leave it at that. So that lack of face-to-face interaction must also be a factor in all of this. Yes?
Yeah, I'm there's a fair amount of research suggesting one, that people are more likely to, they're bolder, more likely to sort of stake out their positions. We see this in the comment boards on news postings, right, where people will, I mean, really just be inflammatory. And then it gets reinforced on social media is the same thing when they'll post things that then they're less likely because the people who see them and respond to them are likely to agree. There's no disincentive not to do it. And I think when people are face to face, it's just a completely different context. Mm-hmm. And it's more humanizing in a way. I mean, I think that there's a body of literature out there that suggests across a range of issues, if people, it's called contact theory, if people are more likely to know people of a certain group, and we can think of this ideological, ethnically, sexual identity, all of these kinds of things, that they're attitudes about them are more positive. And so I wonder if in human conversation, face-to-face if some of this might play out, where there's a give and take and an exchange in a way that actually can even force people to be confronted with the counter position when on social media they can largely ignore it. So I don't doubt that that there's some variation there. But if we continue to move along the path that we do, where so much of our communication is dominated via social media, that proportionally at least, then, I'm less than optimistic.
So I don't get it. Why would people who are more open-minded, more sort of bipartisan, if there is such a person, why are they less inclined to vote? Why would they be less in, like you, what you said before was that the people why would that be?
I think I don't want to suggest that people who are open-minded are less likely to vote. What we really argue is, I mean, think of it. People get all jacked up on what they believe in.
Yep.
And then once they're all jacked up on what they believe in, they really want to make it happen. And so the consequence for them seems much steeper, of the consequence of either getting what they want or not getting what they want. People who are sort of more open to both sides, whichever way it goes is less consequential to them. And so then there's less push internally for them to worry about the outcome. And now, look, this doesn't mean, and we're talking about large end data sets
of course.
We look at this. And so it's not saying that people in the middle don't vote. It's saying that the probability is higher that people who consume more one-sided information are more likely to vote. And so and when you think about an election, even if we're talking about a marginal percentage of people, if we're talking about 5% of people, then this has huge consequences for especially these winner-take-all systems our electoral college winner-take-all, our presidential election system winner-take-all, our congressional districts winner-take-all. So if it's just a few percent in the way that it pushes this, it could have huge consequence.
Does seeing the other side make a difference? It seems like you're convinced it probably doesn't. I mean, in most cases, it doesn't make people rethink their position. So if you can't convert someone to your point of view, what's the point?
Yeah, I think it's the balance of how much you see the other side, that whether it makes a difference. Because seeing the other side definitely makes a difference. That's the whole point. And the same argument for why people are becoming polarized is the same argument that counter information matters. The problem is that people aren't seeing the other side.
They're not looking for it in the first place.
No, and then the digital environment is helping them with that. Big air quote.
Yeah. Or hurting them. Let me ask you this finally. So your work tries to sort of measure and understand this transformation in the political environment. It sounds pretty – is it fair to say your conclusions that you've come to are not exactly optimistic? You're kind of pessimistic about this, at least right now.
I think probably the most recent thing we've done is what's – led me to this pessimism. We did a large N study, survey data, national sample that looked at various types of internet use, from social media to following candidates to reading digital news. And the data also measured pretty much every major political issue that's in public discourse right now, from social issues to economic issues to foreign policy. And what we found was invariably the more people gathered information via digital means, the more extreme their opinions were, both on the left and on the right. And we literally tried to beat this out of the data. I'm a quantitative analyst, and I tried everything I could to adding control variables, subsampling the data, cutting it, splicing it, dicing it, trying to do everything I could to beat that relationship out of the data. I could not find it. And so what that means is it's not just us versus them, I don't like them. It's specific to policy issues. And so people's policy opinions are moving to the polls. And if that's the case, and then we, the reason that I'm sort of pessimistic is because as older generations die off and are replaced with younger generations, these younger generations are more likely to be gathering their information via social media. Yeah. And if that's so, then the future looks like more polarization to me. On the optimistic side, where I think this could have a sunny side to it is maybe things become so polarized and so broken that people just desperately need it to stop. And so maybe the wheels have to come completely off the cart before it gets fixed. And we know that that is typical in throughout American history. That's how it's always been here. If we look at the major upheavals from the Civil War to civil rights, the wheels have to come completely off the cart, and then we find our way out.
Jason Gainis, he teaches political science at the University of Louisville, co-author of the book Tweeting to Power: The Social Media Revolution in American Politics, joined us from Louisville Public Media. Professor, thanks very much for taking the time.
Thank you so much for your time.
We'll take a break and then maybe get a dose of optimism when we come back. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are trying to provide something kind of helpful as we all work out the aftermath of a long and really ugly presidential campaign. This is the part of the process where people talk about the importance of unity and coming together, but how do you do that? And we should probably ask ourselves, as we have been throughout the hour, can we do that? We have guests today who say we maybe can't, that there's some structural things in the way, but our guests now in the program say there is a way to do it, and here's how you do it. Mark Gerzon is joining us, founder and president of Mediators Foundation. It's a group that focuses on problem solving in the public square. He's also the author of the book, The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. And Mark Gerzon, welcome to you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Good to be with you. Thank you.
John Kessler is also with us here in the studio. He's an attorney and president of the Salt Lake Civil Network. It's an organization focused on dialogue and community building. And thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Doug.
We should mention this Saturday, they're going to be hosting, Mark and John are hosting the Utah Citizen Summit. It's a gathering of citizens and leaders who are interested in productive conversation across the political and the cultural divide. We'll give you more details about that as we go along. Mark Gerzon, I want to start with you and something that you have written about, and that is this kind of turning point that that you came to. This was in 1996. You were working with Republicans and Democrats in Washington. You call it in your book a turning point in your political life. Would you talk about that experience?
I'd be glad to. Yeah, it was. I was experienced something that very few Americans can experience in politics, which is that I worked for five Democrats and five Republicans, who were the Bipartisan Retreat Commission for the United States House of Representatives, and they'd been appointed by the head of the Democratic and Republican parties in the House because the House was coming apart. It's been coming apart for many years, and it started in the 90s, and they realized it was coming apart, unable to do its work, and so they called for these retreats. And the question was, of course, well, who's going to manage the retreats? So they formed this committee of five Democrats and five Republicans, and they hired me to design and facilitate the retreats. So suddenly my boss, as it, my 10-headed boss, was half red, half blue.
Yeah.
And I had to create a retreat and manage a process for several years that was satisfactory and illuminating to both Democrats and Republicans. And that experience taught me that when the ground rules are changed and when the intention is clear, namely the intention of building a more civil relationship, that these men and women from across the aisle can work together. But the intention there was relationship. It was creating a better relationship between the parties. And that's a fundamentally different orientation than winning.
Yeah.
Now, of course, you know, during elections, they still wanted to win and have victory. That's only natural.
Yeah.
But the rest of the time, they were focused on relationship. And I think for me, it was a turning point where I've never forgotten that experience. And that's why I say many times, and I will say in Salt Lake this weekend when I'm with John and our colleagues, that relationship is actually the heart of politics. It's actually the heart of politics, and we tend to forget that, particularly during campaign season.
Well, that sort of gets us to Jason Gaines's point that he makes that in an internet era, and we'll talk about the sort of sorting of information later, but just the physical difficulty, the structural difficulty of establishing a real relationship when it's virtual, when a lot of our exchanges are not, in fact, real. What do you make of that? That now we've got the technology. It's hard enough as it is. Now we've got technology that's making it even more difficult.
Well, I agree with Jason that the internet tends to put us in sort of echo chambers or you know, little ghettos where we think with people who we're with people who think alike. But at the same time, I think he's underestimated the millennial generation. I have colleagues who are in Silicon Valley who've created startup companies designed to counteract what Jason is talking about. I recommend people go to allsides.com, for example, which is an internet website that provides the news every day from the left perspective, the right perspective, and the center perspective. And they're starting to partner with schools, including schools across the country, and say, let's start educating young people to understand that the news can be seen from different perspectives and get them more sophisticated about it. So here's a case where an internet website is actually providing the antidote to precisely the poison that Jason was talking about. And I believe the millennial generation is filled with innovative solutions that political scientists who look at large data sets, they just miss.
But what he's saying is that it's just a characteristic of human nature to look for information that confirms, that basically goes to a confirmation bias, that we have a hunch about something, about the way the world works, about the way markets work or the role of government, you know, go down the list. And in the internet era, especially when we have now algorithms helping us sort this stuff, we're not interested in all sides. We're interested in our side. How do you respond to that?
Well, the term confirmation bias was formed and named by a British scholar in 1960. And so here we have a situation where the very thing we're talking about, we're becoming aware of. We're becoming aware that we have a confirmation bias. And we've named it, we've studied it, and we're starting to create alternatives to it. And I think, you know, I would point to a different tradition, and that's the tradition of public education and learning in America, that the founding fathers from the very beginning said, democracy depends on education and an educated populace.
Yeah.
And they built public education into our system because they thought we were learners. They said, you know, people in democracies have to be learners because we're not taking orders from, you know, a king. We're not taking orders from a communist party. We have to decide things ourselves, so we have to be learners. And that's another tradition that I'd like to point to other than the confirmation bias tradition. There's the learning tradition. And I believe that the millennials are also leading the way in that regard. They really want to learn and innovate. And their hero, you know, one of their heroes was Steve Jobs, who created and kept creating new innovations that, you know, we probably have in our pockets now as we're speaking.
Yeah.
And those innovations didn't exist. And that's creativity. That's learning. That's and I think that's part of the antidote to the poison that Jason was talking about.
One of the things that you have pointed out is that people don't always... You're not being so Pollyanna as to assume that people have to come to agreement on everything. You say that it doesn't mean you have to moderate or compromise your values, but there is a way to find some sort of common ground while keeping hold of your positions. Would you explain that?
Well, I think we're going to see that this weekend at the Utah Citizen Summit, actually. I think we're going to see Republicans and Democrats and independents and libertarians, and they're all coming, you know, they're all coming with their own political points of view.
Yeah.
But they're coming together, you know, in Salt Lake to say, we're all Utahns and we want the best for our state. And how can we work together to ensure that from our different perspectives, we make this state the best possible place to live, the best possible place to put our kids through school, the best possible place to have jobs and create businesses. And I think, to me, that's the American spirit. It's a recognition that, you know, we are going to have our differences. I mean, our motto, our national motto is E Pluribus Unum, yeah. out of many one. Well, that honors the many. And it also says the many are part of the one. And I think that's what we're going to be experiencing this weekend in Salt Lake. And I think it's actually pretty exciting because my hope is that Utah kind of says to the country, hey, yeah, we're, you know, a divided country, but bottom line, we're here. We're all citizens of Utah, and we want the best for our state, and we're going to work together. I think that's a message America ought to hear.
Yeah. Your timing's pretty good. John Kessler?
Yeah. I'd like to maybe add to Mark's comments that we also hold this with a developmental perspective, is that a child can understand their own point of view and naturally kind of feels the need to demonize somebody who's different than them. We try to teach in our education to be able to evaluate different points of view and then choose a position. That's another step of human development. There's another step of human development where you realize that if you really listen, there's something to what virtually everybody says, and it's simply worth listening, and something much more rich can come out of that. Then we look at transpolar leadership, the people that have the capacity to hold the broad diversity and to weave things together. It's more of a facilitative leadership. And we've modeled that in Utah maybe better than anywhere else. Mm-hmm. You look at Governor Leavitt or Governor Huntsman, how they're natural conveners. The co-chairs of our organization, our underlying organization, Utah Civil and Compassionate Communities, are Mayor McAdams, the Salt Lake County Mayor, and mm-hmm. Lieutenant Governor Cox, two young political leaders who get it entirely and are motivated to kind of hold leadership and facilitation in this way.
I want to come back to the question of leaders and the kind of role of Utah. I think that's pretty interesting. I wanted to go through a couple of some more basic points. And there was a story, Mark Gerson, that you tell in your book about a man by the name of Sean Long and his experience in college getting together people of different ideas, different philosophies, and kind of working this stuff out. What interested me are some of the ground rules that he laid out. Would you tell me a little bit about Sean Long? This was in Notre Dame, I think it was, the college where
that's
he,
right.
Yeah. Would you? Because I think this is his experience is you tell in the book, and I wanted to just sort of go through some of this.
Well, what his experience was at Notre Dame is happening on campuses across the country, which is, again, why I think the millennial generation was being needs a little more credit than they were being given earlier in this program, mm-hmm. that they recognize that for them to start a Democratic and Republican club on campus isn't exactly innovation. I mean, that's not what Steve Jobs would do on a campus, you know?
Yeah.
He wouldn't look at America and say, oh, gee, let's fix the problem and create a Democratic and Republican club. He would see that as a repetition of the problem. So Sean noticed this. He had a very conservative roommate. They were good friends, and they realized they wanted to stay good friends. They didn't want to start fighting like they saw older people fighting. Mm-hmm. So they started this organization called, you know, Bridge ND, ND right. for Notre Dame. And they said, let's create a place where people can come together from across the political spectrum and talk through these differences rather than polarizing and, you know, starting to create separate clubs to replicate our parents', you know, red and blue positions.
Yeah.
And that's now on campuses across the country. And if people want to learn more about it, they can go to Bridge USA, and bridgeusa.org will help them start one on their campus. But to me, this is a super exciting innovation. And it, again, you won't see this in a large data set if you're a political scientist, because this hasn't started to penetrate our culture yet. But I think we're going to see those kinds of organizations on campuses across the country within the next 5 to 10 years. Mm. And it'll be a major innovation that wasn't there when I was in college.
Well, it's interesting. What are the conversations like? Because some of the ground rules that Sean laid out with his friend to sort of accomplish this conversation, one of them was, as he put it, going beyond debate. That is, you're not just there to argue. You have to move towards some kind of what? Conclusion or action, I guess.
I think it's probably what's happening in the White House this morning. Donald Trump and Barack Obama just finished their meeting in the White House, and they met longer than anybody expected. And I think they met longer than anybody expected because they realized they probably are doing a version of what Sean Long was arguing students should do on the Notre Dame campus, which was they were saying, hey, we've called each other some pretty horrible things over the last year. That's not setting a very good example for the American people. You know, let's see if we can set a different kind of example and treat each other with a little more respect as we go forward. And they're probably rewriting the ground rules. And this is part of the American tradition, which we're in danger of losing. And that's the tradition was, you know, campaigning happens for a few months. And then this thing called governing starts after the election. And we've almost lost the art of governing because I write about in the United States of America that we've entered this period now with this endless campaign where after the election is over, people start the next campaign and every piece of legislation is an effort to get an edge in the next campaign. And that's not what the founding fathers intended. They didn't intend 18-month election campaigns. They intended a brief campaign where you decided who's going to win. And then you went from winning to relationship. You went from winning to governing. Mm-hmm. That's the challenge we face.
It seems like you've got a lot of structural obstacles in the way to getting there, though. And I can't, you know, the money involved in politics is one. The natural conflict that exists between the right and the left is another. Gerrymandered congressional districts. I mean, are there too many structural obstacles in the way to going back to that idea of, okay, we'll fight for a little while, then we'll govern?
Well, I'd like to hear what John has to say about that.
But John.
My view is that it has to do that everything you mentioned, I write about in my book. Yeah. Everything you're saying is true. All these are structural issues need to be handled: money in politics, gerrymandering, you know, a segmented media, et cetera, et cetera. But we're not going to solve those problems unless we follow the ground rules that Bridge Notre Dame was talking about.
Yeah.
We're not going to solve those problems by the Democrats ramming it down the Republicans' throats or vice versa, because we all know that's not a way to create an enduring solution. So that's why I come back to relationship. And I just want to say a word about sports because, you know, politics has gotten confused with like the Super Bowl or a boxing match. We think it's about who wins. Mm-hmm. And it is about who wins until the day after the election. And unlike the NFL, where we don't really care, you know, with the Seahawks and the Broncos, you know, we don't really care about their relationship after the Super Bowl. We care about who won.
Yeah.
But today, we care deeply, deeply about the relationship between Obama and Trump, between the red and the blue, between the Democrats and Republicans, because that relationship will determine the quality of life in America. And that's why I'm arguing so strongly what's happening in this weekend in Utah is so important, because it's about the relationship between Utahns who care about their state and have different political points of view. And that's why I think all those structural issues depend on people coming together in this spirit of relationship and collaboration.
And maybe, Doug, what I would add to what Mark said is you mentioned two legs of a three-sided stool. One is you have to address the processes and the institutions that are becoming creating increasingly polarizing dynamics. You have to have the culture of relationship and listening. The third side of the stool is you have to have individual information and understanding of how to enter into these kinds of dialogues and how to hold these opinions and how not to be alienated from people who have different points of view. So there needs to be education there too.
You know, along that line, it's one of the things, Mark Gerzon, that you've written about is how this path to unity has to lead through, as you put it, our hearts. Explain what that means, because you say that we need to – here's something you wrote. You said we need to acknowledge the liberal and conservative who are inside us. That is, look for this our own kind of inner diversity. Work me through that, if you would.
Well, I don't believe that I'm 100% liberal, and I don't believe my conservative friends are 100% conservative.
Yeah.
I'll just speak about myself. When it comes to and pick almost any issue, when it comes to guns – I don't think we're going to make schools in Utah safer if there's no gun anywhere near a school, because then if, you know, somebody who's crazy comes and starts attacking a school, you can't defend it. I also don't think the school's going to be safer if there's a gun on every hip of every bus driver and every teacher and every parent. So there has to be a conversation between parents how to make that school safer. So I'm a liberal and a conservative when it comes to guns. I'm a liberal and a conservative when it comes to the economy. I'm a conservative when it comes to the national debt. I think it's an outrage that we've burdened the next generation with this incredible debt, with college debt piled on it. So in that sense, I'm a conservative. I think we should balance the budget. But I'm a deep flaming liberal when it comes to the fact that I don't think we should balance the budget by, you know, cutting back on programs that feed hungry kids. So you could almost go down the line, and I have liberal and conservative energy in me. I mean, internet privacy. I'm just the fact that I don't want the government secretly reading my emails or listening to my phone calls, does that make me a liberal or a conservative? You know, I don't actually care. I just don't want them messing with my privacy. So I think most Americans, and the data shows this, by the way, the data shows most Americans are not 100% liberal or 100% conservative. So once we acknowledge that, then we can start to open our heart. And to go to your question about the heart is that every time I've done a deep dialogue, whether it was around climate change with Al Gore and his critics, or whether it was around guns, you name it, or around abortion, it always boils down to opening the hearts of the people who are speaking. And then when they start to open their heart, they start to realize, oh, as you know, just as John was saying, there's some reasonable point. There's a point on the other side that I can actually agree with. And once you go there, the door of the heart is open. Once you go there, the door of the heart is open. And Abraham Lincoln called it fraternal feelings. He said, you know, America is based on the fraternal feelings between the citizens. And I think that fraternal sense of connection and brotherhood and sisterhood, it's in danger of being lost, and why what's happening this weekend in Utah is so important.
And just to build on what Mark said, I don't think it necessarily means that we all have an internal chaos within ourselves or an internal division, that quite often these things that seem separate can be complementary opposites, that you can work things out. And even if they carry a different kind of value set, say, for instance, here in Utah, where we had some legislation that both honored religious liberty and gender rights that was brought together in a complementary way, based on a conversation, even though there wasn't a matching of values, there was a way to optimize what was possible in a richer way than anybody thought was possible when they started.
We need to take a break. Let's do that now, and we'll come back for some more thoughts in a moment. We have with us John Kessler, president of the Salt Lake Civil Network, John Gerzon, author of The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. On Saturday, they're going to be working with Village Square and other community partners to host what is called the 2016 Utah Citizen Summit. It's a gathering of citizens and leaders interested in these kinds of conversations across partisan lines. The event is co-chaired by Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox and Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. There are details about the event on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we are talking about, well, we're asking this question, why can't we get along? Have we ever gotten along? Is it us? Is it technology? Is it systems? Mark Gerzon is with us, founder and president of Mediators Foundation. He's also the author of the book, The Reunited States of America, How We Can Bridge the Partisan Divide. He's going to be in Salt Lake City over the weekend for a gathering, the Utah Citizen Summit. We have details about that on our website. John Kessler is with us, an attorney and president of Salt Lake Civil Network. It's an organization focused on dialogue and community building. I wanted to get you to respond to an email that's come in, because there's a sense, Mark Gerzon, of anguish right now for a certain segment of the population over what happened on Tuesday. And I'm guessing that's where Brandon is. He writes this. He says, how can you have this Pollyanna conversation about civility and reconciliation the day after half the population validated that the very opposite, demonizing, othering, fear-mongering, will win you the highest office in the land? Now, you're going to get a lot of that, I'm guessing, or you probably heard a lot of that already. How do you respond to that?
Well, I respond by saying that in the title of my book, I say how we can bridge the partisan divide. I'm talking about you and me. I'm talking about the folks who were gathering in Salt Lake this weekend at the Utah Citizen Summit. I'm not talking about Donald Trump, and I'm not talking about Hillary Clinton. That's not we. I'm talking about we the people. And they have to play certain roles when they become leaders of these parties. They play these roles, and in this particular election, they played them pretty in a pretty dirty way. But I don't think we have to behave that way. I don't think other politicians behave that way. I think there's a lot of other races that have been very dignified. And I'm when I say we, I'm thinking of, you know, I'm sure there's an organization in Salt Lake called Leadership Salt Lake. There certainly is, you know, there's 230 leadership organizations in cities around the world. I'm sure there's in around America. I'm sure there's one in Salt Lake. And this is Democrats, Republicans, and Independents in Salt Lake who get together, you know, on a regular basis in their little leadership group, looking how they can provide better leadership for the state of Utah and the city of Salt Lake City. And I, that's who I'm talking about. I'm talking about we the people. And I would argue that Salt Lake City works as a community because they're hundreds and thousands of people. They're not asking at their hospital who's a Democrat and Republican. They're not asking at their public school who's a Democrat or Republican. Yeah. They're not asking at their church or their synagogue who's a Democrat or Republican. So while I share, you know, the caller's frustration with the tone of this election, and I share Brandon's concern about the number of people who voted for Trump after the way Trump behaved, I deeply, deeply share that concern. Yeah. I don't think that has to change the way I treat people. And I don't think it's the way that change the way most citizens treat people. And in fact, democracy is about the people leading. So I think the people need to push back. And I hope the people push back. And if there's a politician in 2018 who starts to behave the way Trump behaved, I hope people step forward and say, "Hey, we're not interested in that. You know, we're sick of that." And I think that's we're going to see a backlash. And I already see it again in the millennial vote because I was told that if the millennial vote alone was counted, Hillary Clinton would have won 48 states. So the millennials are repudiating that kind of tone and that kind of what I perceived as bigotry.
What do you mean about getting rid of the what you call an obsolete political map? We need to update our civic software, is how you put it. Can you tell us what you mean by that?
Yes, I was referring to what John Kessler was just speaking about a moment ago, that the old civic software, which could also be called the old patriotism, was I'm going to get involved in politics because I'm right, and I'm going to defend my or my family or my group's rights, and I'm going to argue against them my way or the highway. That was the kind of old civic software. It was a very combative us versus them, I'm right, you're wrong attitude. And I think the new civic software, the emerging civic software, is much more saying, I firmly believe what I believe. I mean, Brandon, who just wrote your email, I firmly believe what I believe. I firmly believe that Hillary Clinton should have been elected president. But hey, you know, a quarter of the people voted for McMullen and a quarter of the people voted for Hillary and a half voted for Donald Trump. That's rough. You know, those are rough generalizations.
Yeah, you're right about that, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm interested.
Yeah. I'm interested in knowing. I'm interested in actually relating to the half of the state that voted for Trump. I'm actually interested in knowing who they are and how they think. And instead of, you know, you're welcome to write an angry email to a radio station, but I would get out and say, hey, half the people I walk by at the supermarket voted for Donald Trump. I think I'm going to meet some of them and talk to them and find out what's going on and find out how did you overlook some of the things that your candidate did? Oh, I see. And drop beneath it, you know, drop beneath the points of view and drop into the heart. Because, you know, we're not talking about some small minority that we disagree with, in the case of Brandon disagreeing. We're talking about one out of every two people who, you know, walk the sacred land of Utah.
Yeah.
Well, and in addition to what Mark is saying is there are a lot of people who are feeling that they have not, their needs have not been met. They have been left out of the system. There's pain. There's frustration. It's a failure in leadership generally in both parties. Yeah. To not embrace the needs and the concerns. And that's where more advanced leadership will come from, that neither political party is modeling at all well.
I wanted to ask you, Markers, on something you toward the end of your book, you write about, you know, some sort of practical steps to bridging this partisan divide. I wanted to ask you about at least one of them. And this is step one. You say, take a transpartisan vacation. Explain what that is.
Well, I feel that we all deserve a vacation from our political identity, particularly after this election.
Right, it gets tiring.
Yeah. It gets tiring. I mean, I would say to Brandon, you know, doesn't it get tiring to be a liberal who, you know, is bemoaning the fact that there are these people called conservatives in America, and they seem to be holding a lot of power at the moment, the presidency, the House of Representatives, the Senate. I'd say, Brandon, you know, take a vacation from being a liberal just for, you know, a couple of weeks, just like you take a vacation, you know, to go to, you know, the Caribbean or to Hawaii, and get away from being a liberal and say, I think I'll read Trump literature for a while. I think I'll read some conservative literature for a while. I think I'll read about some different things that I don't normally read. And like a vacation, you can come back at the end of 2 weeks and completely resume your previous life. But like on a vacation, you know, sometimes something happens, you go, oh, I like that. I like that food, or I like that. I think I'm going to bring that back into my life. And I would bet that anybody who's listening to this program, if they went away and for 2 weeks they read material and listened to speakers and went to websites that are associated with the other point of view, whatever the other point of view is for you, I'll almost guarantee that you'll come back with something of value. And however small that may be, I think that's the beginning of the true kind of new civic software looking for, which is, you know, the civic software that will keep us the United States of America, or what I call the reunited States of America.
One of the, we're essentially out of time. I'll just point out step 10, hold both love and power in your hands. That shifting from the idea, as the columnist David Brooks, whom you quote in the book, the away from the thrill of political hating to the thrill of political loving. We're out of time, but this conversation, I'm guessing, Mark Gerson, you'll be having this weekend here in Salt Lake.
Yes, and I'm very grateful to John and our colleagues there who are putting this on, because Utah is leading the way for the country at this point, having an event like this just a few days after the election. I feel very privileged to be joining it.
It's Mark Gerson, author of the book, The Reunited States of America. John Kessler, president of Salt Lake Civil Network. On Saturday, they're working with the Village Square and other community partners. They're hosting the 2016 Utah Citizen Summit. It's a gathering of citizens and leaders interested in conversations across these partisan lines. Ben McAdams and Lieutenant Governor Spencer Cox are co-chairing the event. You can get details at radiowest.org. John, you wanted to give an email address for registration?
www.utahcitizensummit.org. Anybody can register. We'd love you all to come.
Okay. We have that, by the way, also on our website. Mark, John, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Dan.
Thank you.
Radio West, production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.